Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We certainly do appreciate your tremendous support. Hey, speaking of Iconic, they wanted me to pass along a message to everybody. If you're interested in checking out what they're doing, there's a link in the description that'll get you 10 days free. You can try it before you buy it. They're like the alternative media's version of Netflix. They're making incredible content. Of course, it's got all of David's past work, but also things like a brand new series that they're developing, full-length movies that they're producing themselves. And they've got a really interesting health and wellness component to it that I think might catch some people by surprise. So if you are so inclined, click the link in the description. Just check it out. See what you think. Like I said, you can try it out for 10 days without paying for it. And they've been great. They've been a host to this show since we launched. So thank you to the crew over there at Iconic. Speaking of people that have been with us since the beginning, My Patriot Supply has been nice enough to build us a landing page called preparewithmacroaggressions.com. And through that landing page, you can take a look at everything that they've got, but you'll also get $150 off discounts on the food that you buy. They've got a 4-week supply. They've got a 3-month supply. They've got water purification, air purification devices. They've got camping gear. I mean, hopefully we don't need any of this, but I'll tell you what, and I've been talking about this breathlessly for the last year, at least. You want to be at least, you know, if you're going to be, it's better to be 2 months early than 2 days late on this. And so let's be proactive in our thinking. Let's not wait for the mainstream corporate whore media to tell us to be concerned about the supply chain issues. Let's get out in front of it. So if you are interested and so inclined, you can do that through our sponsor, preparewithmacroaggressions.com. But regardless, whether you're using our sponsor or you're doing it through some other means, start thinking about this, please, because it's not going away anytime soon. And you're going to feel a whole lot better once you know that you've got some of this preparedness taken care of and crossed off your list. Also, thanks to Chemical Free Body. They've been with us from the beginning. Look, if you're going to get yourself prepared with food and supplies and things like that, you're also going to need to get your body ready as well. Chemicalfreebody.com/macro. They built a page for us there as well, where you can try out what they call a detox in a box. I did it last year, last summer. It cleaned me out, man. It is really effective. They're making it with the best ingredients. Obviously, the name implies chemical-free. There's no chemicals in any of their products. And Tim James has been on this show several times to talk about this, the importance of good health and nutrition. You, we're surrounded by poor choices out there when it comes to food and the like. So again, let's be a little bit more proactive on taking care of ourselves. If you are so inclined, you can go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro and check out what they've got going on there and use the promo code macro on your way out to save yourself a little bit of cash. Well, now that we've got the business out of the way, we can get down to the real good stuff. And the first time I went to Anarchapulco in 2019 to speak, I had the pleasure of meeting and watching the presentation by Mark Devlin. So I'm excited to have Mark here from the UK to give us a sort of a lowdown on a lot of things. I'll tell you what, I really enjoyed. So Mark, welcome to the show. Great to see you again. How you been?
Yeah, what's up, Charlie? Yeah, I'm okay. Getting by day. I've got very fond memories of that event, Anarchapulco in 2019. I had a great time there. I DJed a couple of the pool parties doing my presentation.
I saw them. So we were there. I was in the bar with Ole Damegaard and Jason Goodman one night. You came by, you walked by, we said hi. We said, when's your presentation? You said it's tomorrow at, I don't know, 1 o'clock or whatever. And the three of us met up again. Ole, Jason, and I met up before that. We said, we're going. Let's go. Let's go to Mark's presentation. So we sat there and we watched it. Not enough time. They didn't give you enough time. Same as Ole. They didn't give Ole enough time. You know, it takes a while to sort of unpack these concepts. But your presentation was so fascinating to me. And you're an author. You've written, well, now 4 books, 3 in the musical truth variety, volumes 1, 2, and now 3. And you've tried your hand at fiction writing too. We'll get into that as well. Your background as a DJ, is that how you wound up in this, well, let's just call it the alternative media of music, where you were looking at the backgrounds of it? Like, how did you, I know you're a DJ in the UK. I know I saw you DJ at the pool in Mexico a couple nights, and it's amazing. Is that how you got interested in this? Like, how did that all work for you?
It feels like everything that I've done in my life was preparing me for what I'm now doing. So I had a lot of grounding. I had a day job on a business magazine back in the early 90s. It was my first proper day job. And I was writing about stationery and office supplies and how to market them. And if you can make that stuff sound interesting,
you can do anything.
Then you're very skilled as a writer. So that job taught me how to write in an engaging, impactive fashion. Around about the same time, I got my first job on a radio station, and I did background production stuff and worked in the newsroom. And then I worked my way around to doing on-air tech op shifts and eventually becoming a radio presenter. So that schooled me in how to do interviews, in how to kind of project your voice in an engaging way, and how to present and produce shows. And then I became quite a successful club DJ. So I started doing gigs up and down the UK, and I was fortunate enough to get to travel and do a lot of international gigs all over Europe. Came to America quite a few times. I DJed in Australia, South Africa, all sorts of places. And all of these things were getting me ready to be as effective as I could be in what I now do. So the writing was preparing me to put out these books. The radio shows were preparing me to do these podcasts and do all these interviews. And the touring and the gigging was preparing me to do these live talks and presentations. And whereas I used to get excited about going to soul music weekenders and dance festivals and things like that, these days I get excited about going to truth conferences and, you know, freedom events and meetups.
Yeah.
And whereas I used to get excited about interviewing some famous artist like Beyonce, who I interviewed back in the day, for instance, wouldn't want to now, but it was all part of my grounding. Right. These days I get excited about, you know, meeting people like David Icke or Mark Passio. So everything that I did as a DJ has parallels to what I'm now doing. And it's very clear for me to see now that I'm on my rightful life path. It just took me a long time to get here. But you need certain skills and experience under your belt if you're going to do a good job of really making a splash in this kind of arena. So,
sorry, my side kind of froze up a little bit there for a second. So your presentation kind of incorporated a lot of this in. There's the musical side to it. Obviously, you're talking about these bands that have prominent bands that we recognize, and we don't give much, maybe surface level thoughts. And then you dig a little bit deeper, and you go, oh, wait a second, hang on, there's some ties here. That that component of it really sort of caught my attention when I started writing my books, and you start to look into the history of things, and you find out obviously that history is not as it appears. But I never really dug too deeply into. I knew Hollywood was dirty, but I didn't. I always kind of left that to the movie side for whatever reason, which is silly of me to do that. But when I thought of Hollywood manipulation, to me, it was always in the form of maybe television shows or movies or something along that. It never struck me that music was a conduit to getting people to feel a certain way, like the government would care about that. I don't know why I never thought that. It's idiotic of me not to. And then I find your work and I go, wait a second. There is so much to this. And I think the first time I came across your work was when you recorded a tour you went on with Greg Carlwood, right? When you came to US and you guys went around
Laurel Canyon. Yeah.
Yeah. The Laurel Canyon tour. And I watched that and I thought, okay, well, I know about I lived in LA for 20 years. I know about Laurel Canyon. And then I thought, well, wait a second. Do I know about Laurel Canyon? I know what I'm supposed to know about it, but there's a much darker version of this. So let's start with in Hollywood in the 60s and what was going on there and how this sort of what seemingly organic counterculture maybe wasn't quite as organic as we're led to believe. What did you wind up finding?
Well, my work in this area was very much inspired by the work of the author and researcher Dave McGowan, who wrote the book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And Dave's work was pretty groundbreaking because he wasn't a full-time researcher. He was a builder, a construction guy, had his own firm, and he did his research and the writing of his books in his spare time. But what he uncovered was phenomenal stuff. And he didn't do anything other than aggregate and collate information that was already in the public domain, that was readily available to anyone on the internet. So it was newspaper articles, it was obituaries, it was online biogs, it was interviews from the music press, that kind of thing. And he brought it all together and showed how various trends and patterns started to form. And he demonstrates in that book, with a great writing style, a wonderful wit, and a great way of putting a story across, how pretty much without exception, every prominent, key, influential musician on that counterculture scene in the mid to late 1960s, coming out of that small neighborhood in the Hollywood Hills known as Laurel Canyon, had family connections almost always through the father into the world of the military. And different aspects of intel, aspects of government, different aspects of the establishment, basically. And I would suspect that if the music scene were organic and grassroots, as we're led to believe it is, and if these bands get selected on the basis of their great talent and their great skill, and it's nothing more than that, then you would expect to find fathers with ordinary jobs like Dave's as a construction guy or as a lorry driver or a docker or a plumber or an electrician or something like this. But you don't find that. You find that the fathers were admirals, generals, statesmen, diplomats, scientists who worked in government-sponsored bio labs, this kind of thing. And you have to be in a very heavy state of denial or have some sort of ulterior motive or some sort of belief system to defend if you can chalk all that up as just coincidence and one of those things, rather than a very clear pattern which presents the whole scene in a very different light. So his work really sparked my interest into this aspect of where these famous musicians come from. And I've kind of picked up the baton, I guess, and continued his work, because Dave sadly passed away in 2015 on the 22nd of November, the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, of all dates. Mm-hmm. And he's inspired me to do my own digging into so many other musicians, not just out of Laurel Canyon, but out of Britain and all kinds of other places. And the same trends present themselves. So you keep finding fathers in these unexpected roles, and you keep finding family bloodlines. This is very key to the whole thing of how famous people get selected for their roles. Not just musicians, but Hollywood actors, politicians, TV presenters, professional sports people, film directors. It all comes down in so many cases to their ancestry and their genealogy. At the talk that I did at an Acapulco in 2019, I remember going into this dynamic. It was called No More Heroes. Yep. And I was recommending that people let go of all these idols and all these gurus that they place up on a pedestal on the basis that we don't really know who these people are. They have carefully cultivated, carefully manufactured public images, but we don't really know who they are, and they're not our friends.
Yeah.
And over the course of the last 2 years, with the very distinct lack of famous people that have been speaking out against the tyranny and the dystopia that's been dropped on all of us, we've had an indication of just how these people aren't our friends, and they don't represent our interests, and they're not men or women of the people. So it comes down to the fact that anyone in any kind of prominent or influential position has been placed there by virtue either of the bloodline that they come from, or through just how willing they've shown themselves to be to do whatever is required in exchange for their fame and fortune.
Yeah.
This is the concept of selling your soul to the devil for fame and fortune, the Faustian bargain.
Yeah.
So those are the two main ways into the music industry if you're going to become a highly influential musician at the very top of the game. It's either your family bloodline or you've sold your soul and shown just how much you want it.
Yeah, neither of these are very good options. I think a lot of people now nowadays in this time know the story of Jim Morrison and his father, Admiral Morrison, being the, you know, involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident and all that. Now, I would be willing to accept a certain amount of coincidence if this happened maybe once. I could rationalize it in my head and say, well, if you've got a father who's Admiral Morrison, maybe you go the exact opposite way and you decide you just want to do acid all day and be in a band called The Doors and all that stuff. I could maybe wrap my head around that. But when it starts happening over and over and over again, and a pattern begins to form, it becomes undeniable. And one of the components of this that I wasn't aware of, that you mentioned in No More Heroes, was the role of the Copelands in this whole operation, for lack of a better term. And the in-your-face terminology that they use to describe their band, in the case of Stuart Copeland, the police, in terms of IRS records, in terms of, like, elaborate on this in this, because this is a quite literally a family operation, is it not?
Well, that's right. The Copelands were very much at the helm of the whole punk and new wave scene, mm-hmm. on both sides of the Atlantic, actually. Because they're a kind of British-American family.
Right.
The patriarch of the family, Miles Axe Copeland Sr., was a big-time CIA career guy. And he had various postings around the world on secret missions. He had three sons. I think all of them were born in Beirut, or at least two of the three were, in an American military hospital in Beirut, Lebanon.
which screams, of course, intelligence.
Indeed, that's a CIA hotbed, and Miles Copeland Sr. was based there for a period, hence his sons being born there. So his three sons, Ian Copeland, Miles Copeland Jr. and Stuart Copeland, were all put to work in the music industry. The best known of them would be Stuart Copeland, who was the drummer with the group The Police, what's in a name. But you also had Miles Copeland Jr., who kind of ran the business affairs of the family. And as you mentioned there, they ran operations that went by the names of Frontier Booking International, or FBI. They had International Records Syndicate, IRS. They operated Copeland International Artists, CIA. They had their own band, The Police, as in they were policing the other bands that, were part of these communities, part of these scenes. And they really had a stranglehold on that whole punk and new wave scene. So they ran record labels, they managed many of the artists, they handled the touring of many of the artists, they had a TV show on MTV where they would only showcase bands signed to their own artist roster. And of course, they had The Police, who are a highly successful group within that scene. And all of that was run on a military-grade basis by a family that came directly out of the CIA. And they've made no bones about it. You know, Stuart Copeland, in interviews, has spoken of the fact that his father was this secret CIA spy who got sent all around the world on covert missions. And again, if that were an isolated incident, and if that's the only example we have of this, somebody might say, oh, well, it's just one of those things. It's just serendipity. Mm-hmm. But we don't find that. We just find it happening over and over and over again. In fact, the situation with Bob Marley is very similar to that with Jim Morrison, because Bob Marley's father was also a naval officer, a British naval officer, Norval Sinclair Marley, white guy. And he met this black woman, Bob's mother, and Bob was the product of that relationship. But Bob Marley's father also worked for a time on a slave plantation. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Jesus.
And so people will say that Bob, making his songs about emancipation and freedom and rallying against colonialism and the establishment and all this and injustice and stuff, was his way of rebelling against his father's values. And I think they probably were, because I personally believe that Bob Marley's passing was a genuine event. I can't say that about every music artist that we're told has died in unusual circumstances. I do have my doubts about Jim Morrison. I don't necessarily accept that he died in a bathtub in his Paris apartment in 1971 at the age of 27. But I think with Bob Marley, it's quite clear that he was poisoned and he was given a form of cancer, which finished him off. So Bob Marley could well have been someone that was rebelling against his father's values. Jim Morrison may have been more controlled than Bob. I really don't know. But we've got the same dynamic there. You know, a father that was a naval officer and part of the establishment, who would appear to be directly opposed to the values that the son is espousing in his songs. And the examples go on. There's a very famous hip-hop DJ here in the UK by the name of Tim Westwood. And his father was a bishop within the Anglican church system. And he used to do the Thought for the Day show on BBC Radio 4. And then his son, Tim, becomes a DJ at the forefront of the rap and hip hop scene, pushing that whole genre. And that would appear to be, again, the son's values being very much at odds with those of the father. And again, people would say, well, Tim's just rebelling against what his father stood for and going his own way. But we see that dynamic happening many times over as well. We got Jerry Dammers, who was the founding member of The Specials, the two-tone new wave group. And it turns out that his father was also an Anglican bishop. And then the son becomes a prominent musician within that scene. And we just see this time and time again, where the father's profession is totally at odds with what the son ends up doing. And we also get it with the backgrounds of many of these musicians themselves, the grounding of them. A good example would be Mick Jagger, who studied at the London School of Economics. And this is a social engineering think tank, which is concerned with shaping and molding societal and cultural values. That's what they specialize in.
It's where Soros came
studied
out
of. There. Was that?
George Soros came out of there.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So Mick Jagger spends some time studying there, and then he emerges as this hedonistic, debaucherous rock star, mm-hmm. pushing degraded cultural values for the rest of his career. So it's not a natural career path that you would expect from somebody coming out of that institution,
right?
Unless their career has been all about pushing agendas, and unless the grounding they get at these kind of institutions is specifically for this kind of purpose.
Well, let's talk about this, because this is going to blend two things into one. I remember a symbolic moment in the 80s, and I want to say it happened at Live Aid, but I might be wrong about the location. I'm definitely right that it happened about the mid 80s. And it was during the reason why I say I think it was Live Aid is because it was a huge concert, and the Police got done playing, and it was pretty well known from that point on that this was going to be sort of the end of the Police. And I remember they symbolically took their guitars off and handed them to U2. And then, and U2 was doing great at the time anyway, but they went on to, then it became, you know, Joshua Tree and, you know, Unforgettable Fire, Octoon Baby and all that. And now there's still this thing, you know. Now that in and of itself wouldn't have gotten my attention. I don't really even know why I remembered it, but I did remember seeing that. But it jumps out at me now because of the role of Bono. And I love, you know, I'm taking your advice on this. I'm trying to like separate the music from the people. You know, I love the music, the people. I've got big questions about Bono and his role in this global cult, whatever you want to call it. Now, I don't know how much of their ascension was made to happen in the early years. I know that, you know, I don't know. But their continued success in the face of some shitty albums lately, I might add, but whatever. Their continued success has seemed like a mystery to me. And when I start seeing pictures of Bono with the Pope and Bono with the royal family and Bono's getting knighted and all this
Bill
stuff,
Gates,
I go,
Tony Blair.
His buddy Tony Blair. I go, okay, I've seen enough. Is this a situation where he was always going to fulfill this role, or did he take a turn somewhere along? Did he take the offer, or does he have, you know, the sell your soul offer type of thing? Or is there a deeper familiar connection between something in his past that has intelligence ties? Like how did Bono get picked to be this guy?
Yeah. So the Police passing the guitar to U2 seems symbolic of them sort of passing the baton to them, doesn't it? Of
it did
them
to me,
becoming
yeah.
the next big thing.
Yeah.
We've seen this a few times as well. Like when Madonna kissed Britney Spears,
I was thinking
on stage
about
one of these
too.
Grammy shows. It's like she's inducting Britney to be the next pop princess after her. So we see this from time to time. In terms of Bono, I have had a couple of conversations with people that knew him back in the day in the late 70s, early 80s, when U2 first got started. And they've told me that he used to be a deeply religious man. He used to be into the Christian faith, and he would read the Bible and pray and stuff like that, which is very much at odds with what he's now become, because he's basically the devil incarnate now.
He's got the red glasses, and he's got this.
Exactly.
He's got the character in the
alter ego. What is it? Mephisto something.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. And that the pop tour and the Zeropa tour and the Octoon Baby tour, where he would come out as the devil with the horns and everything.
That's right. That's right. Deeply symbolic as well. And you can judge a man by the company he keeps. And he hobnobs with the likes of Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and the Pope and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and George Bush. So that tells you all you need to know about him. He's pushing globalist agendas now. He's advancing New World Order master plans. And he has been for quite a number of years. And he seems to have spent more time in recent years doing that kind of work than he has putting out albums and doing tours. He's less of a rock musician and more of a New World Order oligarch these days. And so this person was saying that back in the day, he used to be a man of faith, and then something happened to him. You know, he made the deal or took the bargain or whatever it was. And his soul was no longer his own from that point forward. But I've done a bit of digging on Bono for my current book, Musical Truth 3. And in this, I'm recounting the background of Bono's family. And it goes all the way back to 15th century England. There was an ancestor of Bono's by the name of Thomas Hewson. And at some point in the family's history, it was decided to relocate them from England to Ireland. And so future generations of that family were born into Ireland. There's a cousin of Bono's by the name of Barbara Hewson. So Bono's real name is Paul David Hewson. And he had a cousin by the name of Barbara, who was a very prominent Irish barrister. And one of her claims to fame was that she campaigned for the age of consent for adults to be able to have sexual relations with children to be lowered to the age of 13. Nice lady.
Was she a member of PIE?
Well, quite possibly. She was also pro-abortion, and she was very controversial. She died last year, January 2021, of cancer, but she turns out to be a cousin of Bono. So now we're suddenly getting into the realms of bloodline families, different generations of them, and new expressions of that family being put to use in prominent public roles. So you had Barbara Hewson pushing all that stuff in her role as a barrister. Meanwhile, her cousin Bono, having become famous as a rock musician so that everyone knows who he is, then begins doing his real work, advancing all with all these New World Order agendas. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to Bob Geldof, his mate and fellow countryman, because Bob Geldof became famous as the lead singer of the Boomtown Rats. Then in the mid-80s, he began doing his real work, which was the Band Aid and Live Aid projects and everything that that led to. And looking back on it now, with the benefit of being able to do the research and with hindsight, we can see that those projects were, in very large part, laying the foundations for what's now being marched towards Agenda 2030 coming out of the United Nations, where they want to take society and how they want to reshape world society. That was being inducted way back in the 80s with a lot of what was being done off the back of Band Aid and Live Aid. So Geldof helmed that whole thing because he was also from an important bloodline family, and he was also what's been termed a lifetime actor. This is a term that was coined by the author and researcher Joseph Atwill, and it refers to somebody who is thought of primarily as one thing or another, so a musician, a singer, an actor, a politician. But when you get down to the true nature of where they've come from and what their affiliations are, you realize that their public role is very different to what most people think. So that's been the case with Bono. And it was no accident, and it was not left to random chance, that he would become as successful and as well known as he did. Yeah. Because it was all about getting him known to the general public, to the point that anything he then did and any agenda he then presented would be accepted that much more readily by people because they've come to know and love him. This is the manufacturing of icons and gurus and heroes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've sent me down this other rabbit hole by bringing up Bob Geldof because, for those that aren't familiar with his Boomtown Rats work, which was, of course, very well known. If you've ever watched the movie The Wall by Pink Floyd, then he's Pink in that. He's the guy that shaves his eyebrows and, you know, does the whole thing. He goes on, he does Live Aid, Band Aid. He's celebrated internationally, a hero.
knighted, which is, by my account,
Sir like Bob,
a ringing alarm bell for anybody that's got a sir in front of their name and the queen is knighting them. Like, they're definitely on my radar.
Never trust a sir, never trust a lord.
No, no, no. And then it starts to make me wonder about his relationship to Pink Floyd and the band. And I wonder about this. And now we've got questions. Do we have questions about David Gilmour's past, right? In intelligence? I'm speculating here 100%, but because I don't know any of these people, and maybe you can help me out with this. But when I see Bob Geldof, and I know that he's got questionable ties. I see his ties to Pink Floyd. I know that there's some questions about them. I see Roger Waters leave the band and start what I would consider to be actual activism. Was there something going on in Pink Floyd that we don't know about? Was there a splitting, an ideological split based on maybe something like this, like intelligence connections, or am I making something out of nothing?
Well, I've got a friend who is working on a book project about Pink Floyd. I interviewed him in 2020. His name's Martin Brown. And he's planning a book that will be not like no other written about Pink Floyd. So he makes the observation that pretty much every biography of the band just draws on the same anecdotes, the same stories, just churns out the same old material. Nobody really presents anything that you've not heard before. And his book is intended to do that because he's looking into the group from a sort of conspiratorial viewpoint, you might say, as an open-minded truth seeker with no agenda to uphold. So it promises to be a very fascinating book. And in the podcast that I did with him, he touched on some aspects of this. He knows a lot about the group, a lot more than me. But he pointed out that they're a very posh group. You know, all the members came from aristocratic backgrounds, very wealthy, very privileged families, with the exception of Roger Waters, mm-hmm. who had a more working class background, or ostensibly working class. One of his marriages, I think, was a bit suspect, but Roger seems to be the black sheep in that group. And when you look at the comments that he's made publicly about the incursions of the Zionist state of Israel into neighboring Palestine, mm-hmm. and some of the committees that he sat on to discuss these matters, you think you've found yourself that rarest of entities, you know, a prominent rock musician with a conscience, with a mind to call his own, who is bravely speaking out to hell with the consequences, just saying what needs to be said. Unfortunately, however, when I put out that presentation titled No More Heroes, I really meant no more heroes, because you do have to throw them all out because you can't trust a single one of them. So another story that I relay in the book results from the research I was doing into prominent music makers and what they'd had to say about the COVID debacle. For the most part, the majority of musicians just said nothing at all. Those that did speak out, most of them were reinforcing the official line and just propping up official narratives. There were very few honorable exceptions who I mention in the book. And hugely disappointingly, there was an interview that Roger Waters did in the midst of this whole era where he's lauding Anthony Fauci.
Really?
He's bigging him up.
Ooh.
He says, "Thank God for Anthony Fauci and all the great work he's doing." And he also describes Bill Gates as a good person.
Okay.
He says, "We've got a lot of good people doing great work in the middle of this pandemic. You know, Bill Gates is one of them." Now, someone of Roger's abilities and intelligence, if he's able to research the situation between Israel and Palestine for himself and come up with his own conclusions in direct opposition to what's told to us in the mainstream media, then he's capable of doing the same level of research when it comes to COVID and realizing that the mainstream account of that whole thing is a crock of crap as well. And so the fact that he's putting Anthony Fauci up on a pedestal, when he's another devil incarnate pushing genocidal population reduction agendas as a eugenicist, unfortunately paints Roger in a less desirable light.
Yeah, that's a shame too.
It's a great shame. It's a real shame.
Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, if, well, I mean, that to me is kind of disqualifying right there. I mean, it's kind of hard to say Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci are doing a good job and then simultaneously say, you know, let's support Palestine, which I'm in favor of, and let's support Julian Assange, which I'm in favor of, and all these things. So it's like, I like this. He's saying the right things. And then you hear that other side and you go, ugh, like another disappointment. I wonder though, there have been a few over the years that I feel like they were trying to warn us and they weren't taken seriously, or maybe they couldn't go all the way and come right out and say it. You get Johnny Rotten doing an interview in what, 1979, I think, where he's talking about Saville and he's saying, I know who he is. I'd like to do something to Jimmy Savile. And this real, you know, this really crazy interview that he gave that now listening to it, I'm like, oh, he knows what's going on. The Smiths put out Panic on the lead side streets that you slip down in provincial towns. You jog around, hang the DJ. And I go, well, that's Jimmy Savile. And of course Johnny Marr and Morrissey are going, oh, we don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
They knew, right? Everybody knew about Saville and this whole thing, the top of
it
the pops.
It seems everybody knew about Saville.
It seemed everybody knew. Nobody was willing to say, everybody knew that there was a price to be paid if you talked about that, right?
Yeah, yeah. The public were the last to know, as we so often are.
Yeah,
and there have been others that have kind of tried to speak out and warn people about what's going on. One that I constantly get told about is Frank Zappa. And interestingly, Frank Zappa ties back into that Laurel Canyon crowd because he was very much a part of that whole scene. He had the log cabin there, which was this venue that he occupied for some time. And it was a meeting place for all the musicians and all the counterculture key people in Laurel Canyon to go and congregate and smoke together and hang out together and stuff. And Frank Zappa was the ringmaster of that whole thing. So he was up to his neck in that whole scene, which was, we can now know, very controlled and had very distinct ties to military intelligence. But Frank also made a lot of public comments in interviews and such, and in many of his songs, warning about the military industrial complex, so to speak, the true nature of the establishment and the elite ruling class and the contempt that they have for regular people and the agendas that they run to try and reduce the population and degrade culture and debase values and this kind of thing. So Frank could well have been one of these artists that went rogue. I think every now and again we get them, not often enough. And unfortunately, there's always a heavy price to pay for this. Yeah. So Frank Zappa died, I think it was the age of 52, thereabouts, which is too young to die.
For sure.
And this was in the early 90s of, I believe it was a fast-acting form of cancer, we're told.
Bob Marley.
And Dave McGowan. Oh. There's a lot of fast-acting forms of cancer around, it would seem.
Yeah.
But they never seem to strike the people you'd like him to strike. I've noticed that as
Anthony
well.
Anthony Fauci's out there. He's fully deserving of fast-acting cancer. We can't get him to win the cancer lottery.
Klaus Schwab, last time I checked, he's doing just fine.
Justice
in the world.
Yeah, Henry Kissinger. What are we getting Kissinger for his 200th birthday? I mean, we have to.
I know, right?
Mark, we have to think about what sort of world we want to leave for Henry Kissinger. You know, when you and I are in the grave. God, it's so frustrating.
I know, right? A lot of people have said to me that Frank Zappa being gotten rid of was part of this clean sweep that was being made in preparation for 9/11, known to be coming in 2001. I've got no doubt that event was planned for years and decades in advance.
Oh, yeah.
In some of my public presentations, I've shown how there was predictive programming pertaining to the events of 9/11. Going all the way back to the 1960s. and that the World Trade Center tower was being constructed in 1968, 33 years prior to that event. Coincidentally, 1968 being the same year that Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey was released, which seemed to be predicting that 33 years into the future, some world-shattering event was going to occur in 2001, and it did, proves that this event was known to be coming a long time in advance. And it's been suggested to me that a few people who would have been expected to have had a thing or two to say about it were removed in the years leading up to 2001. So one of them was Frank Zappa. Another one was Bill Hicks. So can you imagine the events of 9/11 occur? Can you imagine those two guys staying quiet about it?
No.
Also, John Lennon. John Lennon was got rid of a long time before 9/11. But I like to think that if John Lennon had been around in 2001, he'd have had a whole lot to say about that event. So it seems these individuals had to be removed for fear of what the repercussions might be if they weren't.
Well, I can't look at Supertramp Breakfast in America album cover and not think of it. You know what I mean?
When you, I know, right?
When you see things like that. And then we get into sort some of more of the more modern day or a little bit more relevant people. The Chester Benningtons of the world, Avicii, the people, Chris Cornell, the people that come out, for whatever reason, they don't know any better than to, than you're not supposed to announce that you're working on a documentary about child sex trafficking or something like that. You're supposed to keep that quiet, like for reasons that will become obvious to people. Right. They talk about this a little bit and then they wind up dead. It's easy to be dismissive of this. It's easy to kind of be like, well, you conspiracy theorists with your ideas and everything. And I get that. And I'm trying to not be careless, and I'm trying to come at this with a level of, like, you know, trying to be as honest about it as possible. But like, how many times do we need to see these people dying under mysterious circumstances and then finding out that they're involved in trying to expose some bad things before we start to ask some questions? I mean, is it not reasonable to ask questions why these rock stars are turning up dead all of a sudden?
Yeah, we're back to the Geldof family again with this.
Peaches,
too.
Yeah.
With Peaches Geldof, because she had reportedly revealed the names of a group of mothers who had allowed their children, babies, to be sexually molested by Ian Watkins of the group Lost Prophets. He went down for these crimes many years ago.
Yeah, I remember that.
Got a sentence of several lifetimes, basically. And apparently, Geldof had posted on social media about this and had revealed the names of these families. And she'd also spoken about pedophilia within the music industry. And a short while after that, she turns up dead of some sort of overdose, just like her mother, Paula Yates, a few years before, Bob Geldof's former partner. She turned up dead of some undisclosed overdose or other. A few years after Michael Hutchence of the Australian rock group INXS, whom she'd been in a relationship with, turned up dead in a Sydney hotel room on the 22nd of November, again, the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination in 1997. And we're told that he'd had enough of life and decided to hang himself with a belt from his hotel room door. Right. So this all connects back to Bob Geldof, an extremely dark character. You know, I've related this story many times. But as you say, yeah, how many of these incidents do we have to endure before we have to acknowledge that something is going on here? It's kind of like all these professional sports people, these footballers and other sports people that just happen to have been dropping dead on the pitch, right, in games in recent weeks. What could be going on there then?
Because
something is causing this. It's not just random. This kind of thing doesn't just happen. Something is causing this to happen. And yet the mainstream media just seem to be going,
yeah,
nothing to see here. And the vast majority of the general public seem content to chalk it up as just one of those things, because to acknowledge that there is something going on might mean that you have to start taking action and doing something about it, taking some personal responsibility. Yeah. You might have to reassess your entire worldview. You might have to grudgingly acknowledge that the world is not quite the place you thought it was and is not necessarily run by the people and the institutions that you thought it was. Yeah. And it seems most people just don't want to go there. They're not prepared to step out of that comfort zone. And that's why these agendas go on. That's why these things are allowed to perpetuate year after year after year, and they go unchecked. And so many rock stars turn up dead in bathtubs and all kinds of other places. And nobody seems to be asking these important questions. Why does it keep happening? What were these people talking about before they turned up dead? What could be causing all these footballers to drop dead on the pitch? All these important questions that people just don't seem to want to acknowledge.
Well, I know somebody that wants to acknowledge them and wants to have the conversation, and that's you. You have been doing tremendous activism during the, especially right when the lockdown started, with what you were your merchandise and the things that you were out there, you were very vocal about that. What has the response been? What was the response to you during that? Were you taking a lot of heat from it? Because early on, it was a very unpopular. I mean, we recognized it. We knew what was going on. And I think my audience knew what was going on. But the vast majority of people couldn't figure it out. Maybe you can't even figure it out now. But certainly couldn't figure it out right in the beginning stages of it. And that yet there you were, very vocal about it. And forcing people to confront this out there. And I wondered, like, what was the response that you got? It couldn't have been overwhelmingly positive, I would think, because there's so much fear, paranoia, misinformation, and of course, zombification of these people. And you send them out there and they don't want to hear what you have to say. Like, how were you treated by the people that you were reaching out to?
I'd had a grounding of 10 years before COVID broke. So I'd been doing truth research for a whole decade. And I'd looked at a whole load of false flag terror events and psyops. And I'd become very good at spotting the signs, because the people that pull these things off, they're not the most imaginative. No, they're not the most creative. No. They stick to playbooks. They stick to scripts. And they don't seem to be able to deviate from these plans. They've got very regimented computer algorithm type minds. No genuine creativity. So you can see the same patterns emerging time and time again. You can see the same crisis actors being wheeled out, the same agendas being pushed. So with COVID from day one, I knew it was a big scam. Yeah. There was never a single doubt in my mind. The minute I started hearing the news bulletins talking about this scary new virus coming over from China, and we might have to lock certain parts of the world down, I thought, here we go again, more of the same. And so there was never any other option for me than to speak out about it and to try and warn people about what was really going on here. And so I remember one video I did very early on. I think it was about a week or so after the UK had been put into lockdown in March of 2020. And I locked myself away in a spare room in my parents' house where I could just gather my thoughts, turn the computer on, and just spoke for almost 2 hours straight, just pouring my heart and soul into this video and imploring anyone that would watch it to please pay attention to what's really going on here.
I watched it.
Where those behind this want to take things and the dark and dangerous road we're all on, unless we heed the warnings here and do not comply with this madness that's coming in. And the other video that really put me on the map for a lot of people was my famous car rant.
Oh, that's what I saw. That was the one I saw. The car rant.
Car rant. So this was April of 2020, and I'd taken a trip into my local town center. And I'd seen the way that people were behaving, these ridiculous, nonsensical ways that were going against their own self-interests. They defied logic. They defied dignity. They defied common sense. They defied morality. You had grown men, physically strong men, behaving like weak little pussies with a mask on, standing behind a bit of tape, quaking in fear, doing what they're told, standing where they're told to stand, walking around the store in the direction they're told to walk in it. And I was just disgusted by this behavior. And I was just dismayed beyond comprehension at how easily people were giving up their natural born rights and freedoms based on what I knew to be monumental lies. Yeah. The deceptions were obvious from the start for me. And I could just see people giving in so quickly and succumbing to fear and to mind control. And it pissed me off so much that I just came back, locked myself in my car so that my kids didn't hear me ranting and raving. Again, turned the computer on and just ranted and just spoke from the heart. And I posted the video, and that video really put me on the map for a lot of people. So at that point, my YouTube subscriber base was stuck on just less than 10,000. And I'd had that channel since 2008. So that had been 12 years. And it had taken me 12 years to get up to 10K. And within the space of about 2 weeks, I'd gone from 10,000 to 50,000 subscribers because that video went viral and people were passing it around. I started to get hundreds of emails a day from people all over the world saying, thank you so much for that video. You articulated exactly the way I feel about this situation. Thank God somebody else sees it. Thank God you're able to express yourself in that way. And thank God I know I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And so off the back of that, people were then discovering the fact that I'd been on the scene for 12 years. I wasn't just some Johnny come lately that had just started making videos. And they were like, wow, he's put out books. He's been doing conferences for years. And so they started to look at my work into the music industry, and it opened up a new audience in that regard for me. But there was never any question of doing anything different for me.
No.
Because I could see where this world was headed and still is if people don't rise up in their mass numbers and refuse to comply with this.
Yeah.
It was never a question for me. It was never an option for me to just keep quiet.
No.
For fear of what the repercussions might be, who it might upset, what family or friends might not speak to me anymore. Those things just don't figure when this much is at stake. The very future of humanity, the very future for our own children and future generations. If we, who've been charged with the responsibility of determining where things go from here, don't step into right action and do what we know needs to be done. So as far as I'm concerned, everyone should have been doing this.
I agree.
There's nothing special about me locking myself in my car and ranting and raving on a video like that. Everyone should have been doing it.
Yes, but I was glad that of all of the voices that could have been elevated, for whatever reason, the content, the algorithms, or however it worked, I'm really glad it was your voice, because you're articulate and logical. You have a deep understanding of this. You're passionate. You make sense. It's not a 30-second TikTok video that doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, I'm glad it was you and not some dummy, because when you explained it in the way that you did, it just was really difficult for people to kind of deny it. It was an observation that was it wasn't so much like your opinion necessarily. It was more like a measurable observation that was kind of hard to deny. And I think people connected with that, and they understood, they saw your passion, and they knew it mattered to you. I mean, you weren't putting on some sort of act. You were genuinely pissed off. And I think a lot of people were pissed off, and they were tired of being told that they were wrong, or that they didn't, you know, that they weren't seeing this the right way, or they were being selfish, or all the lies that we were told. They just knew they were angry, and they saw somebody that encapsulated their anger, and that was you. And I thought, and so for those, I'll find that video. I'll put the link in the description for people if they want to get that.
Well, it's been scrubbed from YouTube.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
In the last 2 weeks, I lost that channel. So the channel I was talking to you about, I got up to 63,000 subscribers, and finally it went 2 weeks ago. They got rid of me. I knew it was going to come. I knew it was inevitable. So I've got a new YouTube channel now, but I've got Odyssey and all my videos are backed up to Odyssey. So that car rant is still available on Odyssey. I've got a very good friend actually who's been a truther, a kind of awake for years. And he told me that he'd been trying to get through to his partner for many, many years and get her to get on the same page as him. He'd presented her with all kinds of information and she just refused to see it. She just couldn't see what was going on. And he showed her that video and he said the second she watched it, something just clicked and suddenly she could see everything. She could get on the same page as us. And she's since commented that, yeah, that video just gave me the shake that I needed to get me on the right path. And it surprises me to hear that kind of thing because, like I say, it should have been obvious to everyone, I think, by that point that what we were living under was a monumental scam.
Yeah.
And yet sometimes people need it spelled out to them in a certain way. Maybe they need to hear some guy spouting off in his car, getting angry and getting pissed off and just speaking in everyday language and pointing out things that should be obvious, but they're not until somebody takes the time and trouble to point them out. Yeah. So I was just talking about how ridiculous people look standing out in the rain, 6 feet apart. You know, when we've never lived like this before, none of us have ever behaved in this way.
Right.
How are we so readily accepting this now on the say-so of a mainstream media that has a provable track record of lying over and over and over again? In fact, their very existence is to lie and to push mind control and propaganda. So
yeah.
Well, I'm very glad that video did make the impact that it did. Surprises me that it did, but I'm very happy that it did.
Well, everyone comes to this information at their own time, and some people are ready to accept it at some point, and some people are maybe never ready to accept it, and some people it takes something like 9/11 or COVID to shake them out of this. But I'm just glad that they're at the party now. Whatever brought you here, whatever woke you up, I'm glad that you're awake to this. But I wanted, well, let's wrap up on this one, because you branched off and tried something different with fictional writing, The Cause and the Cure. Is there more in your future, more fictional writing?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking me about that, because I feel The Cause and the Cure is kind of the forgotten book in my body of work. So people have very graciously accepted my musical truth books, and I'm very gratified to see the great reception they've had. But I don't feel enough interest has been shown in The Cause and the Cure. And this was the book I put out in 2019. So the title was quite prophetic, the way turned out. It got released at the end of 2019, just as COVID was being cooked up, and it's called The Cause and the Cure. And I had planned to spend 2020 touring this book and going to various conferences and speaking about it. And, well, didn't happen, did it?
But it didn't allow you to go around the world and talk about The Cause and the Cure? Wow, surprising, huh?
I know. It's almost as if something happened to prevent that. But anyway, I wanted to try my hand at fiction, and I'd had in mind for some time that I wanted to have a story that was set in my home city of Oxford, or my birth city of Oxford, England. So I never went to Oxford University. I was never a part of the establishment, the academic establishment there, but it was my home. And it's a very fascinating city to set a story in. And I also had in mind that I wanted the story to be set in the early 90s because I wanted it to be a nostalgia piece. And it draws very heavily on my memories of what life was like in those times, 30 odd years ago. Very different to the kind of society we've got now. Things have changed so much. So on the surface, it's a murder mystery thriller. And people will draw comparisons with the Inspector Morse stories because they were set in Oxford as well. Okay. And on one level, it's kind of similar to that. But it's also got a subplot running underneath, which is all about the acid house rave dance music scene that was really starting to find its legs in the early 90s. So that undercurrent is there throughout. On top of that, it's allegorical and symbolic, and I've tried to layer it. There are natural law teachings, there are spiritual truths, all buried away in the narrative. There are all kinds of clues that readers can decode there's anagrams, there's hidden meanings, double meanings. And I've tried to liken it to a Stanley Kubrick movie. So if you think of one of Stanley's masterpieces like The Shining or Eyes Wide Shut, people have been watching those movies for decades and they might have seen them 20 or 30 times. And on the 31st viewing, they spot something that they've missed on the previous viewings. They're like, my God, there's another clue. Why didn't I see that before? And I thought, wouldn't it be great to incorporate elements of that in my story?
Yes.
Where it's the kind of book that you need to read 5 or 10 times to pick up on all the little subtle nuances that I've put in there. So I've tried to encode it with all of that. It's kind of like an onion where you peel away new layers and you discover what lies beneath. So I did my very best to put that into the story. And my next book now, I've got Musical Truth 3 out of the way. What I would like to do now is a sequel to The Cause and the Cure.
Nice.
So the last story was set in 1990. It finished in the spring of 1991. What I'm going to do is take the story forward 10 years to 2001. I'm going to have the same characters, but it's going to be set against the backdrop of 9/11.
Oh.
And it's going to have its own kind of Oxford version of the 9/11 event. And again, it's going to be loaded with clues and symbolism and that kind of thing.
Oh.
So I'm still racking my brains as to the title. I know I want it to be the something and the something, like The Cause and the Cure.
Right.
And I kind of want it to be The Sign and the Something, or The Something and the Sign. But I haven't quite got the rest of the title yet, but it will come to me soon.
I think if people want to, you know, get ready for reading your book, The Cause and the Cure, they might have to watch a couple Mark Passio videos first, get themselves sort of familiar with natural law, comfortable with those concepts.
Are you trying to say that one of the characters in the book might have been based on Mark Passio?
Is that saying it's possible. I mean, it certainly is possible. There are worse people to create a character around than that guy. I mean, talk about a deeply intense person that actually gives a shit. That guy is a tremendous. Well,
I mean, I got mad in my car that one time. He gets mad on his show every week.
he certainly does. Mark, where's the best place for people to find your work and to connect with you?
Well, it's not my YouTube channel.
Not anymore.
It's gone. So the best place is the Hub website, which is djmarkdevlin.com. So from there, you've got links to all my podcasts. I've got my conversation-based Good Vibrations podcast. I've got my conscious music show, The Sound of Freedom. You can link through to my videos from there. You can link through to my books. All my books are on Amazon. But if you want to get them from me direct, I've got paperback and hardback copies of all the books, and I'm happy to sign these and mail them out to people. I've got an audiobook version of Musical Truth Volume 1 and The Cause and the Cure, but I haven't voiced the other two yet.
Gotcha.
But anything else, people are welcome to drop me an email to markdevlinuk@gmail.com, and I can sort everything out from there. I'm doing a speaking tour at the moment in the UK, so anyone that might be watching this that is UK-based, I'm going all around the country presenting aspects of this book. So again, just go to djmarkdevlin.com and the events page, and you can find out what conferences I'll be touching down at. And actually, we started the show talking about Anarchapulco,
yeah.
And I may be coming back in 2023, because I did an interview the other day with Howard, better known as Etienne de la Boitier Squared.
Yes.
Yeah. And we had a great chat. I posted that to my Odyssey yesterday, talking about freedom and anarchy and his new book. And he runs this turtle release party at an Anarchapulco, where it's a beach party, and by moonlight, you know, late at night, they release a bunch of turtles into the ocean. And he was saying that I should come along to this in 2023. And it kind of sparked the idea in my mind that it would be great to get back to Acapulco then, because Mexico, as things currently stand, is one of the very few countries in the world where you're not required to have taken the three dart finish, the arm spear, to be able to get in.
That is true. Well,
I may be able to get back for that in February next year.
I think we found the name of the new book, The Turtle and the Release. I've had no, I've had
it's
Howard.
It's got to be alliteration. It's got to be the T and the T or something.
Right. I've had Howard on the show too. We've talked about that. And I watched his presentation at Anarchapulco in 2020. And I'm talking to him on the show and I'm telling him about that. I thought it was so cool that they had this turtle release party at Anarchapulco. And he's like, I'm in charge of that. And I was like, you are? I didn't know that. I couldn't.
He's I know.
Like,
that's what he told me as well. Yeah.
He goes, why didn't you do it? He goes, you saw everyone getting on the buses. Why didn't you do it? I said, well, I was on my way to the ayahuasca ceremony. He's like, oh, okay. I understand. You had a ticket to another event. I was like, yeah, I was doing something else. But I was very impressed by the fact that, you know, you go to a conference and it's about anarchy and everything. And you go, what is this? What's it going to be? And I wasn't really too concerned, but I could understand why, you know, maybe normie people would think it was like, you know, Friday night, we're going to have a Molotov cocktail throwing distance contest or something like that. And it was none of that. Like I said, to put it in perspective, Friday night was these buses pulled up and all these people got on the buses. And I remember I was waiting to go to my ceremony and I was sitting next to him. I said, what are all these buses for? They go, oh, it's the turtle release party. I was like, what? And they go, yeah, they take the baby sea turtles down to the ocean and they let them out so that the birds don't get them. And I was like, I'm thinking to myself, that's not the anarchy that most people think of. You know, think of burning tires and broken car windshields. And instead what they're doing is they're like, no, we're taking care of these turtles. And I was like, amazing, amazing. Just again, one of these events where you just never know who you're going to run into there. There's a lot of brilliant concepts and tremendous ideas. I hope you're able to make it. Yeah. Mexico.
I'd love to. My enduring memories of 2019, that event were DJing at the pool party, which was amazing. Yes. Going to that turtle release party and just hanging out on the beach and having some great chats by moonlight. Going to the Elias Clay and Immortal Technique concert, meeting Elias Clay, whose music I love, and swimming in the ocean, chatting to Ole Damegaard and Kim as the wind blew in from the ocean and it's blowing all the stuff off the table. And it was just this beautiful warm breeze. Yeah. Happy memories. I'd love to get back. And that'll be 4 years since the last one, if I make it in February. Yeah. So I would love to do that.
Yeah. Well, in the time since you and I spoke, I wrote a book with Jeff Berwick and we put it out called The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. So I think I might have a kind of a standing invitation. I don't know. Maybe I'll check with Jeff, see if Jeff can get me in.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. And also at the start of the show, you mentioned Iconic and people are going to be sick of seeing me on Iconic because actually this Friday I'm going into the Iconic studios in Derby and I'm recording two shows.
Oh, perfect.
So I'm doing a show with Richard Willett.
Yes, Rich has been on the show a million times. I was emailing him right before you and I got on this call.
Okay, so I'm doing a show with him talking about my music books and current affairs and stuff. And I'm also doing a show called The Banned Book Club, specifically about my books. Nice. And then, you know, your show is on Iconic, so people are going to be so tired of seeing me on that platform.
Hey, listen, there's plenty of content on there. It's not just the Mark Devlin show on Iconic, but or Macro Aggressions, but while you're there, you could definitely check out our stuff. Mark, you're the best. Thank you for everything that you do, for everything that you've done, and for everything that you are going to do in the future. It's guys like you that make, well, you just make this world a much better place. So thank you so much for everything that you're doing.
Well, likewise, brother. You know, thanks for all your efforts as well. And I appreciate you getting me on the show.
Yeah. Well, and if you like this episode, please take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. If you want to connect with me, you can do so through my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. All the links will be in the show notes below so that you can get connected to Mark's books and that video that I will find on Odyssey and everything else. Thanks. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.